Hi, this is Rob Cornelis, and thanks for joining the Game Face Execs podcast. Like you, I'm sure, as a kid, I wanted to hide under the blanket the first time I ever watched the suspenseful Wizard of Oz. But I knew everything would be all right for Dorothy and her friends when we finally discovered that controlling the big bad wizard was a gentle and compassionate man who saw the potential in others and helped make their dreams come true. This week, my guest is Tim Boyle, the warm and humble man behind the powerful and sometimes edgy curtain of Columbia Sportswear. As I've known for years and you're about to hear, Tim is a humble visionary, a faithful steward, and a discreet but generous philanthropist. Tim Boyle, Columbia Sportswear's chairman and CEO, is this week's Game Face Exec. And I really want to thank you, Tim Boyle, for joining us at Game Face Exec's podcast. It's a treat to have you. You're someone that I've admired for a long time, and someone that the business community, the academic community, the entertainment and sports community, the outdoor community, everyone has admired the rise of Columbia Sportswear in the many years that you've been leading it. So thank you for joining us. I look forward to the conversation today.
It's always great for me to talk about the company, so that's fun for me. Thank you.
Well, good. Now, before we talk about the company, I think a lot of people are interested in about your personal story. And you and I are both Oregonians. You've lived in Oregon, I think, your entire life. You were born in Portland, weren't you, Tim?
No, I was born in Tucson.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
But were you raised in Portland?
I was, yeah. My parents were met as students at the University of Arizona, and they lived there for a while when my grandparents lived there. And so I was born in Tucson and moved to Portland.
I see.
2 years ago.
So as the story goes, and I'm going to ask you to complete this story for me. I'm going to set it up. So your grandparents on your mother's side fled Nazi Germany in 1937 with your mother, of course, and they eventually got their way to Portland, Oregon. And while they were here in Portland, they eventually bought a hat company and they renamed it the Columbia Hat Company. And that was after the Columbia River, which anyone who's been to Portland knows that that goes through Portland and intersects with the Willamette River and goes out to the Pacific Ocean. And so while they were leading that company, eventually they turned it over to your father, Neil, your mother and your father, but your mother was really taking care of the family, raising a family, until in 1970, your father unexpectedly passed away. And so you're meanwhile at the University of Oregon pursuing a journalism degree. And I think you were just 1 year away from graduation. Is that correct?
Well, it was actually December of my senior year. So I was halfway through my senior year. Yeah.
I see. So then tragedy hits your family. And your mother has a business. It's got, what, about 40 or so employees at the time?
Yeah, in that range, yeah.
Yeah, and so she's not accustomed to running a business. She's been, as I say, paying attention to raising the family. And then what happens? What happens to the Boyle family at that moment?
Well, the company was a tiny company. In 1970, the year my dad died, the revenue was $1 million. And in 1971, when I came home to help my mom and my grandmother were still alive at the time, run the business, we went to $500,000. So by the early 70s, we'd lost all the equity in the business and, things were bad. My dad had taken out an SBA loan just a month or so prior to his death. And so we were trying to figure out how to pay the loan back, make payroll, et cetera. And the bank rightly so called the note because we didn't know what we were doing. And they said, really, you have to sell the business. So we tried, but a money losing little tiny business like the one that we were running at the time is not marketable. And so the bank said, okay, we'll give you a few more months to figure this out. Otherwise we'll have to liquidate. But the banker had just loaned some money to some guys starting a shoe business in Beaverton. And maybe I can get one of these guys to help understand how to run a business. And so we were very fortunate. We had somebody joined a pro bono board who was one of the early Nike employees and helped us to focus our time and effort and on the right stuff, which was building product that people wanted to buy that had some point of differentiation. And so that was the turning point. And last year we were just slightly north of $3 billion. So
Tim, as to your career path, mm-hmm. You got a journalism degree. I presume that was because you wanted to go into journalism.
Actually, I was planning to go to law school.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Okay. And then your mother calls, essentially, and says, what, I need your help, Tim, or come work with me for a little bit?
Well, it wasn't. She didn't have to call. I mean, I knew, you know, I'd worked in the business as a kid growing up from a young age. So I thought I knew a lot. I actually knew nothing, but I thought I knew a lot. But I did know that we had to help the family out. And so that was my calling. And, you know, that's what happened.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about your mom as well. Gert mm-hmm. Boyle, who has affectionately been termed one tough mother for many, many years. Unfortunately, she passed away in November of 2019 at the age of 95.
Right.
And those of us who knew her, well, we would all say that she was a beloved woman. And yet we don't really know her as a mother. We know she was one tough mother for business, but as a mom growing up and later as you were business partners, essentially, what was she like? If you can give us a little bit of background or a little bit insight into Gert Boyle.
Sure. Well, you know, she had come from a tough spot as a child. She grew up in basically Nazi Germany and being Jewish was not a great place to be. So she had a lot of concerns about German products. We didn't have a lot of German products in the home growing up. And she was she wasn't incredibly religious. In fact, I don't think I'd ever been to a synagogue until I was at my grandfather's funeral. So she really adopted, my dad was an Irish Catholic guy from Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. So we basically grew up in the Catholic Church, and my mom was right there with all the other mothers, but she was quite vocal if someone would make a comment about Jewish people or Jewish religion or whatever. She was right there, and but you know, but other than that, she was June Cleaver, and you know, she's not a great cook, and you know, it was the 50s, so.
Mm-hmm. But she obviously developed a survival instinct, and she. Probably, and I can't psychoanalyze a legend like Gert Boyle, but she probably always felt like her back was against the wall, and she always needed to prove, she always needed to exceed expectations. You mentioned a moment ago her tongue. She was she had an acerbic tongue, very quick-witted. She also had, which a lot of people don't know, unless they know her, she had a fantastic sense of humor, yeah. Despite those difficulties. Where did that sense of humor come from? Did she inherit it or did she develop it?
That's a good question, because the German people are not well known for their sense of humor. But she had a great sense of humor, and maybe that was from my dad, who also had a great sense of humor. But she never took herself too seriously and was quite willing and to make a joke about almost anything. And, you know, I think my grandfather, my grandmother, not so much, but my grandfather had a good sense of humor. So, you know, who knows, but it's helped us a lot in the business in terms of differentiating ourselves, because the brand Columbia is known for a lot of things, but almost singularly for its irreverence in terms of how we approach what some people think is an incredibly serious topic, you know, being in the outdoors. So we take an approach that's that's different, and it's been good for us.
Well, she had a famous line when she's talking to employees. She would say, "It's perfect. Now make it better."
Yeah.
So that's right. I think an attitude that always permeates Columbia Sportswear.
We really try and live by that mantra.
And you mentioned this kind of irreverent attitude. That sounds very familiar when you consider that other company across the freeway from you in Beaverton, Oregon, Nike. You grew up at about the same pace, about the same time. You shared ideas. I know you're a very close friend of Phil Knight, and I know you've been a very close friend with all the leaders at Nike. What was it about that era, perhaps even that geography, that kind of created that pushback attitude that spawned these wonderful businesses?
Well, you know, it's really serendipitous that both companies are here in Portland, in the Portland area. You know, who can say anything other than laudatory things about what Phil Knight has done really for the area and for his business in terms of growing it and making it the juggernaut that it is today. So it's nice to be sometimes discussed in the same sentence with them, but you know, they're a very large company, global, and we've really tried to emulate in many ways what they do, but at the same time being different and distinctive. And so, you know, maybe it's the fact that many places in the world think if you're from Oregon, you're either a logger or a fisherman, and sort of that's what people do here. And there are a lot of people who do those things here, but there are other things as well.
So getting a degree in journalism, having a desire to become a lawyer, by the way, what kind of law did you want to practice?
You know, it's a good thing that I didn't go into law, because I had no idea what being an attorney meant, when it was. And so I would have ended up being a bad attorney. But, you know, growing up watching Perry Mason, you sort of said, okay, I guess that's what an attorney does. So I think I did the right thing.
Yeah. Well, you have this spirit of innovation. And I would even say it must run through your veins, because your mom had it. Certainly your father had it. Probably started with your grandparents, but you have really been kind of at the core of the innovation that has driven Columbia Sportswear since you became involved with it in 1971. And you have innovated, you've created products for the outdoor world. So Tim, I know you're going to deflect this and you're going to say you put good people around you, but you have to have a unique talent to be able to inspire the kind of creativity that comes out of Columbia Sportswear. So I have to ask you, what have you discovered about yourself in the last 40, 50 years since you've been running the company?
Well, I guess what I've learned maybe to be a capable merchant. And when you talk about how to run a business in a competitive environment like the apparel and footwear business. And by the way, we talk about this all the time in the company. Nobody needs another brand of apparel or footwear. There's plenty in the US, but if you go to China or if you go around the world, there are thousands of apparel companies. So who needs another one? So that means if you're going to exist in this business, you better be different. And that's where we've taken the approach to focus on innovation and focus on technologies that can differentiate our products that we can own. So we've invested fairly heavily in people and the capabilities of developing our own commodities and products that get turned into consumer products. So that's been a focus for us, and it's really served us well. And then our marketing really needs to also be different and have a different tone than others. So again, it's about being different. Maybe it's the same in every business, but specifically in the apparel business, where if you silkscreen your message on a t-shirt, you are in the apparel business. And so the barriers to entry are low. And so, you know, there you go.
Well, you talk about being different. And first of all, and you also talk about marketing. So I know you've told this story 1,000 times, probably 1,000,000 times, but for those listeners and viewers who have not heard it yet, the story about the whole marketing around your mom, how did that originate?
Well, again, it's about a focus on differentiation, and our advertising agency at the time, we were a very tiny company, maybe revenues of $5 to $7 million, something in that range, recognized that there were certainly not very many companies then, call it in the early 80s, and there's not many today, but there certainly were fewer then that were operated where there was a woman president of the company. My mom was president at the time. And so they said, you know, we really need to explore how we might point out to consumers the differences about Columbia. And when we had an ad rejected by the New Yorker magazine, we really knew we had something. So, you know, that was sort of the way to get noticed on a small budget. And it really morphed into something that was quite effective for the company.
And was your mom a willing participant, or did she go into it begrudgingly, or?
Oh, no, she, sometimes we said, hey, Gert, we make this stuff up. You don't really need to, you know, live this tough mother thing the way you do. So she enjoyed it. There were a few times where we may have asked her to do something that she thought was not ladylike, but she was ultimately a good sport and did it.
Excellent. Of all the innovations, all the inventions that have come out of Columbia Sportswear, Tim, I know it's like picking a favorite child, but is there one for you that it was kind of the turning point that once we did this, and I have a sense that I know what that might be, but I'd like it from your perspective. Which is the innovation that really turned the tables for the company and helped the explosion?
Well, I always remember the interchange jacket that we developed, which basically took a garment that was in the marketplace in many different forms and allowed us to make it in a way that could be used in multiple different ways. So you could buy one jacket, the liner, which was insulated, zipped out, and that really was a very different product. It fit well into our system of marketing that had Gert describing it in many different ways. And that was really what launched the product and launched the business on the back of that kind of product. But we've had others since then, including probably the most famous is our Omni-Heat reflective lining, which was developed in-house, and we sold more than $1 billion worth of products with that lining, and we continue to innovate on that reflective system to give us a constant flow of new products coming out using that technology. So there's a few, but there's really those two probably stand out.
And then when it comes to securing accounts, you know, whether it's a relationship with a particular organization or association or event, was there a particular moment, again, that you reflect back on and you say, that really was a difference maker for our company, that achieving that win from a sales perspective, if you will, because we at Gameface Execs, we like to really talk about how everything we do revolves around the sales process, right? Mm-hmm. Nothing happens at Columbia until someone sells something, just like in any other business. So was there a particular sales event where you landed that account, you said, boy, that was really also a turning point for us?
Well, you know, if I think back about it, I mean, that's been my focus, has been sales and merchandising. And so for our company, those two processes are so intertwined that it's hard to pick out a particular event where we opened an account or we made a sale that made a difference. It was really the blending of those selling and talking to customers and having them say, you know, if you just did the following to that garment, I would buy a lot more. And so having the ability to make those changes to accommodate a customer request was probably those were the times when I remember that. In fact, our interchange garment, which was so impactful on the company, was really designed during a sales call that I made to a company in Grand Junction, Tennessee, which doesn't exist anymore. It was a catalog operation called Dunn's, and they sold products for upland bird hunters. And so we talked about the garments we were making, and they said, you know, if you took this lining and maybe zipped it around a little bit, we might. So that was a meeting that had significant impact on the company, but it was more about learning and listening than it was about, you know, making a big sale.
Can I ask you about that as a salesperson, as an expert salesperson that you are? And I'm not trying to flatter you. I'm simply asking, how do you balance listening to the customer and learning from the customer, but also portraying an expertise that the customer trusts? Because sometimes a customer doesn't really want to give you ideas. They just want to know what you're selling. Just tell me what you got. And other times they want to be collaborative, obviously, and they want to provide input. So how have you in your career and how does your team balance that? Hey, we have to be out there and listening to the customer, but they also expect us to bring expertise and knowledge to every discussion.
Right. Well, you know, in our business, we always talk about being around for the long term. So it's not about like the real estate business where you're making a transaction, wiping your hands and leaving. That's a different kind of selling. For us, it's, we want to be on your sales floor in your store for a long time. And if we're going to do that, we have to be more profitable and turn at a higher rate than the other brands that we're competing with. And if we're doing that the right way, you may want to buy 500 of something. And we say, you know what, you really need to be buying 200 and turning it more frequently to give you a higher profit at the end of the season, so that when I come back to see you next season, you aren't asking me to take back merchandise or somehow compensate you for your bad decision. So it's really about as much as possible getting data from our retailers so that we can be a partner in terms of managing the inventory levels. And you know, we really learned that in spades in the tiny bit of work we did at Walmart. You know, you're familiar with the Sorel brand that we bought in, I think it was 1993. We bought that brand maybe. Anyway, I haven't remembered. I think it was 93. Anyway, their biggest customer when we bought them was Walmart. Today it's Nordstrom, and it's a much different business. But at the time it was Walmart, and Walmart gave you every bit of information you could ask about how your products were selling so that you were a partner in terms of making them successful. And that's, we don't do any business with Walmart at all, but that's something we learned early on in working with them, is how important the data is and selling the right amount of merchandise, not as much as possible.
That's interesting. Have you, at Columbia, have you had a fail, a big fail that you can tell us about where great lessons were learned from it?
We've had more than one. but when I think about maybe important failures, you know, when we first launched our internet, our interchange garments, it seemed like it was a Midas touch. Everything we touched that we put this garment into, that we put this innovation into, worked. And So we had multiple jackets. We had hats that you could take the lining out of. And then we also made a pair of ski pants with a zip-out liner. And our retailers started describing that as Rubik's pant, because once you put it together, there was no way you were going to get it back together. So we've learned over time that you can extend products only so far.
Interesting. Now, I want to talk about today, where Columbia Sportswear is today, if we could. First of all, something that probably of all the people listening and watching this, very few of them can say this year that they are taking less salary than Tim Boyle is. And what I mean by that is earlier this year of 2020, you reduced your salary, I believe, to $10,000. Yeah. Can you tell us why? Why would you do that?
Well, it's not the first time I've done it, frankly. So in the past, so we've been a public company since 1998, and we've grown at an incredible rate, and our investors have done quite well with the shares. But I'm the largest shareholder, and frankly, that comes with an obligation to do the right thing for the business. And so when times have been challenging for the company, I felt it was important that I led by example and made sacrifices that I was comfortable making, but I wouldn't want to ask employees to make sacrifices that I was not prepared to make. So I made a significant reduction in my salary, and our key employees also made reductions in their salaries, which was laudable. But that's how I felt. It's really important to do that, and so did so.
Is it true that of the close to 9,000 employees you have today, you make the least amount this year in salary?
Yeah, I'm definitely in the low quartile. That's for sure. But yeah. We have a bunch of employees who live in Asia, and so
sure.
I don't know where, but by probably I'm the lowest paid, which, people have said I'm finally getting my true value for the company.
Well, you're certainly the lowest at headquarters.
That's true.
Yeah. Regarding your employees, you at Columbia do a lot to support your employees, not just the ones at headquarters. And how many employees of your 9,000 or so do you have there at the world headquarters in Portland?
Oh, I would, somewhere in the 1,000, maybe that. Yeah. Like that.
And as you mentioned, you have a lot in Asia and around the world. But you've done some very interesting and frankly compassionate things to build up the skill set and the financial literacy, the future of your employees, whether they even remain with you, the things that they're learning through you right now are going to benefit them and their families for years and perhaps even generations. I'm thinking about the HER project, for example. Can you describe for the listeners a little bit about that program or any others that you're doing that really are meaningful to you?
Yeah. Well, it's especially important to talk about this, frankly, in today's America, because there are a lot of people who don't find the international nature of business to be a positive, and I'm happy to explain why I feel differently. So, when I was growing up, after the Second World War, inexpensive consumer products were available, just beginning to be available from Asia, and really they were all made in Japan. And as Japan grew and became more financially and economically stable, their rates of pay and their status as employees grew, and it became impossible to make products in in Japan that were inexpensive. So production of those kinds of commodities moved to Taiwan. They moved to Korea, both of which are now so strong economically that it's impossible to build inexpensive consumer products there. They've moved to China. And frankly, we have a big business selling product in China. And our folks who run that business say, we don't want to really sell products that are made in China because they're too expensive. So we make products in Bangladesh, in Vietnam, we make them in other parts of the world, in Southern Africa, where those people will also be lifted up by the economic boats that are going to be floated by international trade. And what we find in areas of the world that are quite poor, that women oftentimes are manufacturing their products and they don't have all the educational opportunities, obviously, that are present for more developed countries. And so we've established a process where we partner with the factory and provide education with the HER project on a number of topics, including health, family wellness, and especially financial acumen, so that these women can bring themselves out of poverty and frankly be great family members, parents, and bring their families up from categories of illiteracy into education and really significant sustainable focus on their lives. So it's good. We enjoy doing that.
When someone in your leadership team brings an idea to you as far as, here's a new area of corporate social responsibility that I recommend we approach or we enter into, what's going to get a yes from you? Is there a sweet spot for you personally where when you hear it, it just instantly resonates and you want to move forward?
Well, again, under the category of differentiation, I mean, I think we want to make sure that we're doing things that are different and unique. One other area is a collaboration with a company called Planet Water, where we build water purification towers in communities where the children of the workers in our contract factories live, where they don't have the ability to have clean water for hand washing, for consumption, for food. And we can provide those fairly inexpensively. So we can put a lot of them in place. And it's a different area that others may ignore or not think as important, and maybe not as impactful. So those are the kinds of things that for me, make turn the needle for me.
Yeah, and I would think that these are my words now, but I see kind of the planet as Columbia's playground, and yet so there's a dichotomy at face value. Getting people out there into the outdoors, way out into the outdoors, as you often say at Columbia, suggests that we need to go and enjoy the planet. And yet the dichotomy that could be there is at the same time, we want to preserve the planet, right? We want to protect the planet and let nature have its own course. So can you give us a little peek behind the curtain as to the kind of discussions that you have within the walls of Columbia Sportswear about that?
Sure. Well, you know, that's an interesting topic because we have many competitors who talk about their focus on the environment, which is laudable. But again, under the category of being different, we think we provide as much or probably even more support to the environment than our competitors, but we can't shout about it because it doesn't resonate as being a point of differentiation. So we focus on on areas that can be really impactful. As an example, we've invested heavily in processes and systems to help us load our containers in Asia, destined for places around the world, much more efficiently. So we reduced the amount of containers that we're pushing around the world to you know, reduce greenhouse gases, but it's also a contributor to positive earnings for the company. And that's just one example of how we might approach being different and making a difference, which is key.
Now, Tim, just a couple of more questions I want to ask, and that is, if you were to bring someone into the Columbia family, how would you describe the kind of employees, the kind of coworkers that would fit and be successful in your world, in your culture of Columbia?
Well, you'd have to have a sense of humor, mandatory. And I mean, frankly, you're going to work really hard. You know, we don't have a huge organization here. We have a fairly thin management group. People who work here make a difference in a lot of different areas. They have responsibilities which are broad and require collaboration. And all those things mean working hard, working long hours, and getting along with people. And you better have a sense of humor, because you're probably going to be ribbed about some topic which is going to hopefully not offend you, but you know, make you sharper.
Right. So you haven't mentioned really any kind of qualities that I could acquire in university or in trade school. You're talking more about personality traits. I assume it's because you know that you can teach those skills if you find the right personality.
Right. Well, it's, you know, you have to have a, I think you have to be able to accept criticism. That would be important. You have to have sort of an innate embrace of education. So it may be that you didn't graduate from college, maybe you didn't attend college, maybe you you learned along the way, but you continued to learn, and that's critical, because we don't really expect someone who graduates from college or has an MBA to step in and understand how to be a contributor. But we do expect people to understand that, hey, you're going to be learning, and you're going to have to continue to learn. And that's important.
My sense of, you know, just from what little I know, Tim, my sense is that Columbia Sportswear is going to be around a lot longer than you and me and probably a lot of the members of your leadership team. It's going to be around. So what I'm about to ask is not, it's not a prophecy. And it's certainly not a death wish, but I'm curious, if you were to write the inscription on the headstone of Columbia Sportswear, what would you want it to say?
Well, hopefully we made a difference, right? And it's people and companies that make a difference get remembered, and those that don't. So hopefully we made a difference, and that's, you know, then we won't, it won't be a an inscription stone. It'll be remembered in people's psyches, you know, when they think about the outdoors.
Well, you've made a difference in the community where I was raised, in Portland, Oregon. You've made a difference around the world. In fact, I don't know if you can tell, but I'm actually wearing one of your shirts that I happened to wear this particular shirt, Tim, on a very momentous occasion. I took my one of my sons. We had a chance to go to Africa, Namibia specifically, and we had a fantastic, life-changing experience. We were wearing Columbia Sportswear gear the entire time, from head to toe, and that object you see behind me, perhaps over my shoulder, that's one of the take homes from that wonderful trip, and what beautiful people we experienced there. And so anyway, I took Columbia with me on that life-changing experience. Well, Tim, I want to thank you again for your time. Thank you for your insights. Thank you for what you've done, not only for Columbia Sportswear, but for all the communities in which Columbia exists and does make a difference in the lives and the careers of people. And you better their lives and their careers and their communities. And I know you, I know you personally, you're a humble person. You typically like to deflect credit, but I just want you to know in front of my audience that you're a tremendous man, tremendous leader, and I appreciate it and I admire you greatly.
Well, thanks for the compliments again. We have a great team here and they make me look good, which is a challenge. Thanks for your help today. I enjoyed chatting about the company and about what we do. So thanks.
All the best to Columbia for the rest of the year and beyond.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being a part of this episode of Game Face Execs. If you found any of it useful or helpful, please rate or like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. I always appreciate you referring us to others as well. I'll see you next week. Until then, persuade, influence, inspire.